This is your host, Dr. Rick Klofein. So happy to have you with us today. We're going to have a fascinating show today on a book called Food Energetics, The Spiritual, Emotional, and Nutritional Power of What We Eat by author Steve Gagné. And he'll please correct me and forgive me if I pronounce his name incorrectly. This is a great show for us. Temple of Health is brought to you by Millennium Healthcare, our holistic group practice in Atlanta, and Dr. Susan Culp's Plasticose practice, our plastic and reconstructive surgery practice. We're pleased to bring you shows that impact what we do. I'm a physician practicing in Atlanta for 20 years. I'm a gynecologist. I'm a holistic physician. My interest in natural healing long predates my interest in medicine. And it was initiated when I was an organic farmer for 5 years as a young man. And I was very interested to get hold of this book, Food Energetics, because I was reading it right at the same time I was preparing a lecture that was called Introduction to Energy, Medicine, and Vibrational Healing for a holistic medicine series I'm giving. And I really was fascinated by this book because this is about food energetics. So when we think about food, and we think about energy, and we think about energy medicine, we understand that there's a vibrational underpinning of all of reality and everything that we do. Steve is an independent investigator and researcher, and a teacher, a Whole Foods educator for many years, for decades. The first edition of this book was 16 years ago. This edition is twice as large. I liked what Steve had to say about food because it was looking at things at a more subtle level. It was sort of getting to the underpinnings of things and looking at a more subtle and a much more holistic level, because there's much more for us to understand about a plant than the components it looks like when we, in a reductionist way, break it down and just look at it nutritionally. And I loved what Steve has to say about looking at the life of the plant and the way the plant grows, the energetic characters of the plant. This is all very interesting because food, by human use, has been refined into herbal medicines. And herbal medicines have been refined even further into vibrational healing medicines, such as homeopathy, and flower plant essences, and the concepts of plant spirit medicine. And the topics that Steve presents in this book, looking at food, is really looking at the subtle underpinnings and vibrational energy of the plants, and that they have more to offer us if we can understand them and get to know them better. I like what he has to say about deprogramming the way we think about food and food systems. I greatly appreciate him always taking the time, including decades of traveling around the world, to study indigenous food systems, because I think there's a lot of wisdom there for us. I like how he encourages us to think outside the box and to, once again, always look at ancient wisdom and dietary traditions as a clue from what might help us. Rather than being down on eating meat, he isn't at all, he's down on our modern meat-producing culture and how that's done in agribusiness and our farming practices, and really I think that's where the illness is as well. So I'm happy to have an hour to talk to Steve. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, thank you very much. Speak up, please, because you're sounding a little soft to me.
Oh, okay.
Well, and we'll get our technician to take care of that as well. First of all, I'd like to make sure I pronounce your name correctly. Can you tell me?
Yes, it's Gagné.
Gagné, thank you so much. So we have Steve Gagné on the phone. Where are you calling from?
Colorado.
And as I understood from looking at your website, and I think your website is wonderful, you have a large selection of articles that give a good feel for what you're talking about. Did you grow up eating modern American food?
Well, I did, but I lived with my older sisters due to the death of my parents and at an early age, so they were always into the the early vegetarian natural foods movement in the back in the early 60s and so on. So, you know, I was introduced to healthy food, but really didn't have any principles or direction with it. You know, as there, you know, back then there really wasn't much.
But you might have grown up eating a better diet, are you telling me, than the average American diet for most people?
I'd say until, I ate the average American diet until probably 14 anyway.
Yes, I see.
Yeah.
And then when was it in your life that you started having a transition? I know that you were educated in and live a macrobiotic lifestyle deeply in that tradition for many years. When was the shift for you that you started to gain a deeper awareness of the power of food?
Well, that's interesting because my introduction to macrobiotics was back in the early 70s, about 1972, and I was a jazz musician, had moved from Maine to Boston at the time. And, you know, I couldn't pay the bills real well just being a jazz musician, so I started working at the first natural food store in the country, Erewhon Natural Foods.
Right.
And that introduced me to the whole, you know, natural foods movement from the macrobiotic perspective. And then, you know, I found a lot of discrepancies there with and confusion in the macrobiotic concepts. You know, it was kind of limiting. So I started to reach out more to study Ayurvedic medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, and begin to travel and try to resolve some of these questions I had about, you know, the confusion about all these diets that are out there. And so, you know, we all understand the idea that we are what we eat. And of course, modern nutrition has proven this, you know, by the fact that, you know, calcium, our bones need calcium, our muscles need proteins. And so as this study continued for me, I realized that, you know, food energetics and traditional practices of food take that saying, we are what we eat, two steps further, and it explains how and why we are what we eat. And that was just absolutely fascinating to me. So I just really pursued that, and that's how I came up with this stuff today. What I'm talking about in my book is nothing new, really. It is just kind of organized thoughts from traditional cultures all over the world, because like you said in your introduction, you liked how, you know, I was discussing in the book how, you know, people understood food from a different level, an energetic level, and that's how traditional people see it. In my travels around the world, I mean, the whole weights and measures system of calcium, vitamins, and they just can't relate to that kind of thing, but they can describe to you exactly how a plant grows and the behavior of a certain animal that they eat, and how that is kind of incorporated into one's nervous system when they consume that. And it's interesting. It's consistent everywhere, this kind of thought pattern that we sort of left behind with the onset of a little over 100 years ago with the kind of analytical approach to food and nutrition.
This consistent thought pattern among indigenous nations is really an archetypal way of thinking about food in relationship to the natural world, and really about the fact that they are not disconnected from the natural world like we as modern society are. And applying that archetype, it can take on whatever the flavor and culture and color of that particular culture and society are. And it amazes me that there are various indigenous groups around the world that eat such completely opposite diets, and yet within the indigenous groups, they live long, healthy lives without tooth decay and without chronic illnesses, so from Eskimo diets to jungle diets.
Yes, so true. You know, what's interesting to me now is in the last year or so is where science is headed with nutrition. And, you know, it's been a process of constantly confirming this energetic thought pattern. You know, sometimes energetic seems very simplistic, but one example that we can use is the simple walnut, which is a food that has been around for millions of years. And, you know, if you crack open a walnut visually, it kind of is this convoluted structure of the nut itself is similar to the like if you were to open your skull and look at your brain. So ancient people thought that walnuts were brain food. And, of course, now, through modern science, we confirm that it is the only nut, tree nut, that has omega-3 fatty acids, which are linked to, you know, supporting brain function, neurological functions, and so on. And you find these confirmations showing up in modern nutrition, confirming energetics all over the place. I mean, you know, the whole idea of leafy green plants being, there was a study done back in 1982 of leafy green plants and how they support, like, can help asthmatic sufferers and people with respiratory problems. So, of course, the modern nutritional science analyzes this. They find that that magnesium appears to be the constituent there that supports the respiratory system. Yet magnesium and calcium and these substances exist in dairy products as well, but they don't have that same link. So from an energetics perspective, we see the leafy green plants as the respiratory system of the planet. They do the opposite of our lungs. They where our lungs take in oxygen and release carbon dioxide, these green plants are doing the opposite. They're taking in carbon dioxide and releasing oxygen. And then we further get the confirmation on these green plants through chlorophyll and chloroplasts. And you know, we can go on forever, you know, with the idea of how this affects the respiratory system and so on. But basically, you know, there's this confirmation going on. And the latest thing in modern nutritional science is molecular communication, which is taking it to a whole different level. Even the study of phytonutrients, as you know, is a whole different network of pathways in the body and that differ from vitamins and nutrients. These are the constituents in a plant that give it its smell, its taste.
The things that make
so
it
we're
beautiful.
Entering now in modern science the realm of energetics that is just, and it's just fascinating to see what's happening with the whole communication and molecular communication aspect of where nutrition is going.
So the confirmation that you're speaking about is so important to help the left-sided brain modern person understand what's going on. But the original idea, this document of signatures of plants, is a ancient idea. The idea that the walnut looks like the brain and it helps the brain, and that the green leafy plants look like lungs, and the streaming network and the way they grow make them plants that we can move into a reciprocity with around our lungs. This idea of the document of signatures is an ancient idea.
Very much so.
Yes.
And you know, in a sense, like what you're talking about, too, is we're looking at food at a level unlike we have in the past, but in recent history, that is different. I mean, this is really our most intimate relationship on the planet.
Yes.
Because what we eat will become us. I mean, we can have our partners and our mates and have wonderful relationships on that level, but this one, as far as intimacy, goes very, very deep.
And it's intimately making a relationship with our mother, the earth, and the natural world. And our loss of connection to our food on all levels, just on practical levels of where it comes from and how it's obtained, and the more energetic levels of how important how that process is carried out is something that we as a culture in America are completely disconnected from. When we walk into a supermarket, we are completely disconnected from that. It disconnects us from, as you say, our most intimate relationship and from the natural world. And I think a lot of the problems we face are related to that. And this is the most simple way on a daily basis that we can start to reestablish that connection in very simple, easy ways.
Yes. Yes. You know, there's one example that I didn't put in the book, but it kind of hits home with a lot of people when you think about it, because if you travel around the world, every traditional culture has their unique spin on chicken soup. Okay, now, you know, it seems simple enough, but why do they have chicken soup? And the purpose for this particular thing in terms of health and healing is the same everywhere you go, whether you go to the Middle East, Northern European countries, or wherever. It's always the same. It's always a soup that is comprised of chicken and vegetables, and it is used for the sole purpose of helping people who are ill to recover, to get up off that bed of illness, or sometimes even the deathbed, it's been considered. But people who are, ill and, so chicken soup has a long history throughout the world of being beneficial for this and supportive of people getting back on their feet. Now, why wouldn't we find beef stew or pork stew or something like that for this purpose? When through a Western nutritional approach, we could see, pork, fish, beef, they all have the same, they're all protein, and they're all supportive to people's health in some way. Why is it chicken? Because if you look at the character of the chicken, its behavior, its nature, it's a very animated creature compared to, say, a cow, who kind of lumbers along all day and very slowly. And, a cow or a beef stew is more conducive to, building and giving that kind of grounded, almost warrior-like status of strength and endurance. That's the kind of historical reference we have with that kind of red meat and so on. Yet with the chicken, you have this flighty, animated creature that when made in a stew, the ancient people considered this to be a, uplifting, an animated form of nourishment for when one is ill. And, it's crossed all these cultural barriers, which is just fascinating,
Because it, regardless of the context of the culture, it works.
Yeah, that's right.
I like what you had to say about phytochemicals, because I just find it so fascinating that the explosion of scientific research on all the different phytochemicals and their benefits is so, it's amazing what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it just completely floors me that all the things that make our foods beautiful and smell wonderful and look beautiful to the eye and aesthetic and pleasing are the things that are beautiful to us.
Yeah.
When we take them in, they're beautiful, they're beautiful, they're healing.
Mm-hmm.
Leading to the idea of food that's also pleasing to the eye and pleasing to all the senses, I think.
Yes, yeah. That's where variety comes in too. The eating various parts of the plants, like the root vegetable, the root plants, beets, turnips, radish, carrots, those kinds of things that have a function in their own lives of a specific role to play in nature. And that role for the whole plant is to absorb and assimilate. So, these correspondences were made between the foods of and the people of ancient times, where this is absorbing and assimilating inorganic minerals from the earth and water and so on, the root plants. And, that correspondence to the intestines, and absorption and assimilation in our own guts, you could say, is so we find that is a supportive food that is there to benefit us in many ways.
So when we start to talk about the energetic signatures of foods, we start to see them more as just a blob of food. We start to get to know them the way you might know anybody else, any other creature intimate in your life, your friends and family, and know their personalities and what their natures are, and even your pets. You start to get to know the different foods and what their personalities are. I think this is sort of a lot of what your book is about.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Because if what we are is what we eat, then how we combine the personalities of our foods. Everybody knows if you want a good party, you don't have all the same type of people there.
Mm-hmm.
You get a good mix, have a good time. And how you're feeling might depend on what you want to do, which should also maybe influence what you want to take into your body. Can you start to talk to us a little bit about the personality of food?
Yes. I kind of break it down in as simple as possible in the book into what I call temperaments, and which are basically, you know, personality and character of a food. So we find that from a Western perspective, we find that protein-rich foods and high-fat foods have something called, or produce in the body something called thermogenic effect, which means the body increases metabolism and increases warmth of the body. So we can find that the temperaments of certain foods affect our temperaments. An overconsumption of heavy, fatty-type foods produce a temperament of overheated and overstimulated metabolism. So you could say, like, and it's really an intuitive thing. It's not something that we can look at intellectually and really analyze too well. If I were to say to our listeners, you know, how would we classify using an animal, a duck, in terms of a temperament of hot, cold, warm, or cool? Now, Ayurvedic systems, traditional Chinese medicine use these kind of things. Well, we know that a duck is high in fat and is able to withstand cold temperatures in its environment. So naturally, this would be a hot damp type of effect on the body. So its temperament would be hot and damp. The same with a cow, who can withstand cold temperatures and produces red meat, which is highly thermogenic. That has a temperament that is hot and damp as well. So whereas a raw salad, leafy green plants, which consist mostly of a lot of energy that is reaching toward the sunlight and growth and releasing kind of appearance and energy in nature, also high in vitamins and nutrients, low in fat, low in protein. So these kind of things have a more cooling effect on the body. So that's why we have meals that consist of a combination of different types of temperaments of food. And then there's even textures that have temperaments as well, like, you know, soft and mushy foods, you know, tend to go with a temperament or personality that tends to be soft and mushy as well, or kind of a pushover. And then you have real strong-tasting foods, which have temperaments and personalities of, like a strong taste, like chili peppers or something, which have a dominant characteristic about them. So each food has its own kind of temperament, and then we have been, you know, evolved to a level where we can manipulate food and nutrients to our benefit. We can change those temperaments. Like, we can take that leafy green plant that has a temperament of cooling, and we can kind of prepare that with olive oil and garlic and, you know, some seasonings, and we can add a little more of that thermogenic property or warming aspect to the fat or oil that we use. And but originally every food has a basic temperament, and those foods are available for us to alter our own temperaments, our metabolism, even our way of thinking.
Lots of different people. Different people need different things.
Yes, for sure. And that's why there's no diet for anyone. I mean, you know, that I suggest in the book, you know, to just really take the best and experiment with a wide variety of foods and see where your needs are being met and where they're not.
And, you know, I like in the book, because it's clear that when you describe the temperaments of food, none of this is good or bad. That's not what it's about.
Exactly.
A food's temperament is just what it is.
Yeah.
And, of course, in the system you speak about, as in all Eastern medical systems, it's all about balance and flow. It's all about things balancing each other's, and just like you're saying, you could take one food that has a certain temperament, but you can alter that and balance it through the energetic preparation process, how you prepare it. And that it's really about, you know, getting everything in balance and flow, so it's all goodness and not really about good or bad. Too much of something or too little of something could be good or bad. But, of course, in our Western medical science, and Western science in general, this whole idea of the philosophy and paradigm of practice fitting into some order through balance and flow is mostly not there. And just like in all other medical practices, health is largely dependent on flow of life force energy and the influence of everything else that influences life force energy. But in Western medical science, life force energy is not part of the equation. So when you present these topics, it's interesting to me, your response, because this is really, for the average American, this is, I think maybe there's a circles that are that are expanding, getting bigger, that are more open to what you have to say here.
Mm-hmm.
How's your response been?
Response is good. I mean, you know, of course, I've got a lot of support out there with Michael Collins' books and the big trend now of getting everyone getting back to the earth. I mean, in New York City, for crying out loud, they're plowing up their lawns and putting little gardens in.
Right.
This is happening everywhere. So there's a very strong movement of getting food back on the table and getting it back in the quality that it should be, and away from the whole processed food movement. You had mentioned the whole idea of good and bad in what you were just saying, and it kind of triggered that thought for me that in my travels and meeting with traditional people, the whole concept of good and bad with food, and even more so the concept of more is better, that we deal with in the West in just about every dietary approach that we use. We discover something, or modern science says that this tomato is high in lycopene, for example.
Right.
So our interpretation in the West is like, let's eat a lot of tomatoes so we get this lycopene and help our immune system and so on. Or, whatever it may be, the latest thing. And this kind of thinking is very foreign to traditional people, whether they be hunter-gatherers or agricultural people around the world. They just can't relate to it. I've had many discussions with them about these kind of things, and they just kind of smile and laugh. The idea that more is better at something is just very strange to them. So I think it's definitely a Western thing, and my sense is that it comes from just so many years of processed foods that we have developed. This deep level of biochemical and emotional and spiritual craving for balance, and we're basically unsatisfied on very deep levels. And the food can bring that back, can help to restore some of that by understanding the character of the food and the personality and so on. That, like another one that's big today is we're importing goji berries from the mountains of Tibet, and they're sold in the health food stores as, something like candy, where you're eating handfuls of them. Whereas, in China and where these were used, the wolfberry, these were mostly used in herbal remedies. These were not something you eat by the handful.
They were not food sources.
Yeah, so, it's this more is better idea, or good and bad with food, is something that I think that the new trend of getting back to whole foods and everything is going to help us cure ourselves of this kind of thinking, which is very odd.
Yeah. Well, I think what it is if you go into a health food, one aspect of this is if you go into a health food store today, the health food store, typical mom and pop independent health food store, all the supplements they have there is all a still Western reductionist approach thinking.
Yeah.
It's not pharmaceuticals, it's supplements, but it's still of the same mindset, very much of the, in my opinion. Still very much of the same mindset, and in both cultures, whether it's pharmaceutical or health food store, they're both creating and supporting illnesses that sell products, whether they do it consciously or unconsciously isn't my point. And I agree with you completely. I think that, and that doesn't mean I'm against supplements or against drugs. Although I think that the systems within which they're distributed are both very broken. I think movement more towards appreciating these energetics of foods are what can help us remedy these situations, and also are what we have available to us to work with every single day, all the time.
This
is Temple of Health
and,
Radio.
You know, just understanding the cultural contributions. I mean, you know, we don't, you know, the olive oil is an example. I mean, look at the contribution from where it came from and everything, from Greece, from Italy and everything. This is a major contribution to people's health. And every culture seems to have contributed something in the realm of food in some way from their culture. And it's a beautiful thing, really.
We're going to take a quick break. This is a Temple of Health radio show. We're speaking with Steve Gagné and his book, Food Energetics, the Spiritual, Emotional, and Nutritional Power of What We Eat. We'll be back in a minute.
So you had plastic surgery. What was it like?
It was great. Don't get me wrong. It was surgery, but the doctors and staff at Plastico's were terrific.
Honey, you look like $1 million. You actually went to Plastico's and had it done.
Why don't you? Plastic surgery is outpatient, and you'll only be out of work a few days. I love what Plastico's did for me, and looking my best is an investment that pays in so many ways. The help you get from the professionals at Plastico's is a bargain.
Plastico's, 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available, 770-457-4677. Headaches, back pain, migraines, joint pain, nothing worse than the nagging, unending discomfort of daily aches and pains. If you have pain and are looking for more natural solutions to eliminate your pain, Millennium Healthcare is for you. Millennium Healthcare's professionals will work for you. For help or more information on natural pain relief, call Millennium Healthcare at 770-390-0012. That's 770-390-0012. Millennium Healthcare. Pain relief naturally.
Don't you just hate trying on bathing suits? Wait a minute. You look great. Plastic surgery?
Not surgery. I got an endermology treatment from the experts at Plastico's.
What's endermology?
Endermology is the terrific non-surgical treatment that Europeans have been using for years to tone, skin, and contour the body. Endermology by Plastico's feels great, and you can see the difference it makes.
No kidding. Who do I call?
Plastico's, a leader in plastic and reconstructive surgery, is the number one center in Atlanta offering endermology. For more information and a complimentary consultation and treatment, call Plastico's at 770-457-4677. Plastico's Endermology Skin Toning and Body Contouring, 770-457-4677.
Welcome back to Temple of Health Radio Show. I'm your host today, Dr. Rick Klofein. I practice out of Millennium Healthcare, which is our group holistic practice in Dunwoody. We have multiple practitioners to serve you, including classical homeopath, licensed psychotherapist and hypnotherapist, allergy elimination and holistic chiropractic, family practice, traditional Chinese medicine, massage therapy, licensed estheticians, owned by Dr. Susan Cole, board certified in plastic and reconstructive surgery, and her associate, Dr. Yalef, who practice out of Plastic Coast, their plastic and reconstructive surgery practice. We're happy to bring you many educational opportunities as well. Temple of Health Radio Show coming up for March will be the 14th, Saturday. Stephanie Marone, The Natural Medicine Guide to Autism. The 21st, Christian DeQuincy, PhD, Consciousness from Zombies to Angels. The 28th, Joseph Chilton Pierce, who will be back with his book, Spiritual Initiation, The Breakthrough of Consciousness. The third Thursday of every month, we're happy to bring you our Noetic Science meeting. Thursday, the 19th of March at 7:30 in the main office in Dunwoody will be Randall Carlson speaking on The Great Year of the World, a synthesis of ancient and modern perspectives on cycles of global and planetary change. Looks interesting. I see in the description there's keywords like sacred geometry, geomythology, and archaeoastronomy. Sounds interesting. I'm Dr. Rick Klofein. I'm board certified in gynecology and holistic medicine, and I'm pleased to practice holistic gynecology every Wednesday at Millennium Healthcare. Please check my personal website, www.aumdoc.com. That's AUMDOC.com. In March, I bring you the Urban Shaman series. On Tuesday, March 10th is our two-hour session, The Medicine Wheel. Tuesday, March 24th is our two-hour session, Ritual and Ceremony, on www.aumdoc.com. And you can reach Millennium Healthcare in Plastic Coast on the web at www.templeofhealth.ws. That's templeofhealth.ws. Or call us at 770-457-4677. That's 770-457-4677. We're pleased to be back speaking to Steve Gagne. Food, energetics, the spiritual, emotional, and nutritional power of what we eat. Steve, this would be a great time to give any contact information you'd like to.
Oh, okay. You can contact me at steve@stevegagne.com. And my website is just stevegagne.com.
So, let me initiate our second half here. Please feel free also to lead the conversation in whatever direction interests you. But I have to say, tell our listening audience that the last third or quarter of the book called Part 4, The Forbidden History of Food and Agriculture, I found to be very fascinating. It's a fresh or a re-examination of the relationship of man to, of developing man to food, and examination of long-standing ideas and new ways of seeing things, and it must be fascinating traveling around the world and seeing folks firsthand.
Yes,
a lot of this information.
Yeah, go ahead.
Please. I'm not sure I had a specific question other than it must be fascinating.
Oh, yeah, yes. And you know, the part that you addressed there, the historical relevance of our food and everything, it's filled with questions still. I mean, our science
yes.
is in its infancy in discovering this. But, you know, we have had all of these traditional myths, legends, oral traditions, they all carry a grain of truth. And, of course, you know, some of them are symbolic and, you know, often taken out of proportion over generations and generations. But, you know, in that section that you're talking about in the book, especially about concerning grain and, you know, the whole evolution or process of where grain came from, the concept of taking a wild field grass and planting repeatedly over and over for about 1,000 years is about how long they say the you know, orthodoxy says it takes to produce this. You know, you can almost imagine when you look at this, like the little child saying to his mom and dad, you know, as they're out there planting these wild grass seeds, and the father or the mother tells the child that, well, we don't know when, but at some point in the future, this will turn into something we can eat.
Right.
And this goes on generation after generation until finally the fourth or fifth kid is, the generation is saying, you know, Grandma and great-grandma and grandpa and great-great-great-great said the same thing, and I think you're full of, you know.
Right.
I mean,
hello.
It gives one the idea that these ancient people were dumb and stupid and would actually do something like this. When there's no oral tradition or legend anywhere that speaks of this repeated planting and planting of a wild type of plant and suddenly it becoming, you know, something edible in the form of barley or wheat or whatnot, and still scientifically we can't find many of these progenitors, these things that led up to these things. But every traditional culture, without exception, has its culture bearer tradition of ancient people of different races, different types, who had previous knowledge of agriculture, of technology, even on some levels, that came and brought more primitive cultures these seeds and these things and taught them how to grow. We find it in Central Mexico traditions. We find it in Native American traditions with the three sisters bringing corn, beans, and rice. And then, you know, we confirm it today with these incredible symbiosis of corn, beans, and squash. And, you know, agriculturists today, they visit these places and they see, wow, planting these three foods together, like it's been done for thousands of years instead of monoculture, supports the soil.
Right.
You know, the corn that's grown is produces scaffolding for the beans to climb. The beans produce nitrogen, which generates, aeration and nutrition in the soil. And then the squash, the leaves and everything, break down into compost for all three of them. And so, you know, we confirm some of these ancient legends that have been kind of shrouded in symbolism or myths, but they're there. And the bottom line is that there's not one traditional food that modern science can dispute is healthy in some way. In other words, modern nutritional science supports every traditional food, whereas traditional energetic thinking does not support any of the modern processed foods.
And everything that we see in new science that's coming out, new science about the origins of food and when and the origins of man, new science about ancient structures under the sea and things that are, you know, just are really, really strongly questioning traditional, conventionally held beliefs about the origins of things.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, it seems as though our practice of agriculture, our level of involvement just keeps getting pushed further and further back into history. I mean, it wasn't more than 2 years ago that 10,000 years was the standard criteria used in academia for the origin and beginning of agriculture. And now they found in the Middle East, they found seeds of emmer wheat and others that push this another 10,000 years, up to 20,000 years now. So, you know, the past is a mystery, but I think one of the links there, one powerful link to understanding it is the study of food, because we, you know, the more we find consistency among different cultures and the more we have new discoveries that show up that where foods are actually preserved in some way, whether they be carbonized or whatnot, it just keeps confirming that, you know, human beings have been around a long time in a spiritually evolved state. And it kind of leaves us with the, you know, today 90% of the planet is developed in modern technology and everything else, but there's still that 10 or maybe more than 10% of hunter-gatherers that still existed out there in the remote rainforest and still doing stuff that was done, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. Now, why haven't they evolved? Well, why haven't the apes evolved? So we have these kind of questions that are there, and you know, if we look at ancient times as possibly being a reverse of what is going on today, like maybe 10% of ancient times, 30, 40, 50,000 years ago, were advanced agricultural peoples that declined as a result of catastrophes or whatnot. And the rest of the whole world, 90% or less, were hunter-gatherers. Why is that not a possibility when there's so much evidence to support that kind of?
It's a very good question, isn't it?
And yeah.
I think it's a question that more and more people will be asking because the evidence will leave them no choice as more and more evidence comes to the forefront.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard to stay stuck in ways of thinking one way when more and more evidence comes out that you just can't deny.
That's right.
I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm just saying I think that's what's going to happen is the event, you know. And if that's happening, like you said, just 2 years ago, that's happening so rapidly now.
Yes. And I think the key to it really is finding those correlations. Because, you know, when we talk about this stuff to, I mean, you have a listening audience, and obviously from your background, you have opened many, many people's minds to a lot of things that they might not ordinarily think about. But, and that's just a wonderful thing. And I think that, you know, with this, the more that we can confirm with our modern science these things, like like I was mentioning before, the confirmation of modern nutrition to ancient energetic nutrition is ongoing and consistent. You know, everything from oysters, you know, an oyster producing 500 million eggs. Now, there was, in ancient times, people didn't know that, you know. I mean, they couldn't put a oyster under the microscope and say, okay, well, you know, it produces 500 million eggs at once, but they knew that it increased seminal fluids in men. They knew that it lubricated and supported vaginal juices in women and therefore was considered an aphrodisiac by any place that ate oysters. So today we know that they're high in zinc. They're high in all kinds of different things that support these sexual organs and reproductive organs. So in a scientific sense, sure, they are aphrodisiac in that sense. So we're getting a lot of this confirmation, and I think the same thing goes with ancient history. The more you had mentioned these undersea discoveries off the coast of, well, one of them off the coast of India and another one off the coast of Okinawa.
Right.
Now, in order for these to really exist as man-made structures, it really pushes the conventional thinking back a lot further than some would want it to.
Right. It's not accounted for in the traditional thinking.
Right,
which is difficult. If you want to continue to hold the traditional thing, there's a whole bunch of difficulties here.
yeah. But, you know, if we keep looking for those links and keep talking about them, we find that they can be supported, you know, through both conventional and traditional wisdom.
It's been very interesting to me, shifting just briefly, to a conventional agribusiness. It's been very fascinating. I'd like to hear your brief perspective on this. It's been very fascinating to me energetically that as an American culture, much of the chronic diseases we face are because we live sedentary lives and eat the diet, the poor diet that we eat. And we take our major food source, which is completely cost inefficient, animal products, let's say beef, and we take them from their natural state when they may be healthy for us, and we take them and we make them reproduce us, meaning we make them sedentary through our raising practices, and we force them to eat a horrible diet, and then we consume them. The whole energetics of it is just so horrible.
It is. It's frightening, really.
It is. It really is the whole business of of all our food production, but it hits closer. It's more cutting when we talk about animal food production.
Sure. And a lot of concepts have come out of this kind of thing. I mean, a lot of vegetarians or vegans say about, well, it takes some exaggerated amount of grain to feed one cow.
Right.
So therefore, one shouldn't eat the cow. But the understanding here is a little.
I agree with you. I agree there's a misunderstanding.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, if you go to Scotland and you go to different parts of the world, these cultivatable land. I mean, this is mountainous regions, and that's very different. And cows don't eat grain anyway. Not naturally. They shouldn't be eating grain. They've shown that the stomach acid in a cow is an extremely high acid level compared to a grazing cow. So these unnatural practices are really, like you say, it's the bottom line. It's not a matter of whether one should eat the animal or not, like you said before. It's a matter of how they're raised. And, you know, so we get these kind of ideas that come out of agribusiness that are actually being used as support for various types of diets today,
right,
from almost a sentimental perspective.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a real problem, mistaking the act of eating meat with the dysfunctional way it's produced in this country. Another way, I say the same line of thinking I face often with prescription medicine. So, as a holistic physician, I'm very thankful for my prescription pad. There's things I can do with my prescription pad that I know no other way to do. As a modern physician, I'm very happy to have it, but I think modern medicine is completely broken in the way they use their prescription pad, the way they use drugs. And this has led many people who come into my office to think that anytime you take a drug, anytime it's evil, it's bad, it's horrible. And it's sort of like it's the same kind of way of how this is twisted with the whole animal thing, that it's terrible to eat animals because of the way they're produced. Well, it's all about intent and doing and how it's done. There's vegetarians that eat wonderful diets. There's vegetarians that eat horrible diets. There's carnivores that eat wonderful diets. There's carnivores that eat terrible diets. Interesting situation we find ourselves in.
It's really about keeping it in perspective. I mean, you know, some of these the drugs that are prescribed are absolutely necessary. And, you know, to take an attitude of extremism to any of it is, it doesn't help anything, really.
Yeah, I think we need to try to avoid dogma. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't learn, but I think you just say, you know, I think we have to take a little care. Are you writing or teaching? What is your life about these days?
Yeah, I travel around. I do seminars, you know, on this. I have a slide presentation that is, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8 hours long. Can be a one-day seminar or a two-day seminar. And, you know, it's a very colorful presentation. And, you know, getting the visuals. I mean, we've had a great conversation today and all, but, you know, seeing the presentation with the slides of different animals and different plants and, you know, just diagrams showing how this all works just really, really hits home for people. It makes a lot of sense. So I want to eventually put this thing on my website so people can just kind of scroll through it with some text and get the visual aspect of it. You know?
Are you working on another book?
I kind of left off with the whole idea of some of the concepts that toward the end of the book of how we're eating today, you know, dealing with issues like different types of diets and everything. And I really would like to do another book on the mentality of diet and what that's all about compared to, you know, what's left of tradition in the on the planet and how they perceive things, how they understand things.
Oh,
we talked about a little bit of that. But.
I think that would be wonderful. We're at a rare cusp here where there's still ancient wisdom available to us.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be a cusp.
Yes.
We may be approaching a point where that will no longer be. And I think so.
Yes.
Any way that we can draw from that and learn from that and bring it into our modern understanding, I think, is very valuable work.
Well, it's great that we have torchbearers like you out there and, you know, people that are carrying the spirit of openness like
that. Well, we all come into a circle that makes it a little bit stronger for the next person to step into and a little bit bigger and broader. We're moving into our last minute or two, Steve. Can I ask you just to give a brief inspirational message to our listening audience?
Yes, with food, I highly encourage people to explore and take the attitude of support locally, but eat globally. And that means eating globally means to introduce new foods that might be helpful to you that you never thought of. Like, for example, one of the things coming in the health food movement is coconut oil. Now, this has been saturated fats have been, condemned forever in America, but coconut oil is a higher in saturated fat than any animal fat. Yes, it has proven health benefits. So try to keep an open mind, explore new foods, and do not do a mono diet. Please don't repeat the same thing every day because energetically it creates the same kind of thinking where one is stuck in their concepts and has trouble getting out of freeing their mind and opening to new ideas.
Eat a beautiful rainbow-colored diet.
That's for sure.
Thank you very much. This is Temple of Health Radio Show. Your host, Dr. Rick Klofine, speaking to Steve Gagne in his book, Food Energetics, The Spiritual, Emotional, and Nutritional Power of What We Eat. Thanks for being with us, Steve. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
I'm sick and tired of always feeling sick and tired, and I don't want to take a lot of prescription drugs to feel better. Isn't there a better way?
Millennium Healthcare offers natural solutions to your health problems. Millennium Healthcare is qualified healthcare professionals working with you to restore your health and wellness. Whether it's a caring physician, one of our natural providers, or our natural apothecary, Millennium Healthcare can help. For more information, call Millennium Healthcare at 770-390-0012. That's 770-390-0012.
You had plastic surgery, Bill?
You bet I did. I got tired of the wrinkles around my eyes and decided to have Plasticos do something about them.
But I didn't think men had plastic surgery.
Get with it, Bob. Men want to look their best, too. There's nothing wrong with getting a little help from Plasticos to look on top of your game. A lot of guys are doing it, my friend.
Well, I don't know about this.
Look, you see the difference Plasticos made with me. I look better and I feel better. My Plasticos surgery was an investment in me.
So where is Plasticos?
Plasticos is in Dunwoody. Plasticos is staffed by pros who guarantee you personal attention. The Plasticos number is 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available. 770-457-4677.